Hello and welcome to your GCSE Law Revision podcast. I'm so glad you're here because today we're diving into one of the most important topics in your entire specification, the sources of English law. This is topic 1.2, and I promise you, by the end of this episode, you'll not only understand where our laws come from, but you'll be able to walk into that exam room and absolutely nail any question they throw at you on this topic. So, let's start with the big picture. English law comes from several different sources, and your examiners love testing whether you understand the difference between them. We've got parliamentary lawmaking, which gives us acts of parliament. We've got judicial lawmaking through the doctrine of precedent. We've got delegated legislation, equity, and historically, EU law. Each of these is a distinct source, and each has its own rules, advantages, and limitations. Let's begin with Acts of Parliament, also called statutes. Parliament is the supreme lawmaking body in England and Wales. That's a crucial phrase. Write it down. Parliamentary sovereignty means that Parliament can make or unmake any law it wishes, and no court can override an Act of Parliament. How does a bill become an Act? First, you'll often have a green paper, a consultation document. Then comes the white paper, setting out firm proposals. After that, the bill goes through five key stages. The first reading, where the bill is simply introduced, no debate. Then the second reading, the main debate on principles and MPs vote. Next is the committee stage, where a small group examine the bill in detail and propose amendments. Then the report stage, where the full House considers those amendments. And finally, the third reading, the final vote. After passing one House, the whole process repeats in the other House. And here's key legislation you must know. The Parliament Acts of 1911 and 1949. These limit the power of the House of Lords. They can only delay a bill by 1 year. Then comes Royal Assent. Since the Royal Assent Act 1967, this is a formality. The monarch no longer personally attends. And at that moment, the bill becomes an Act of Parliament, law of the land. Now, once we have an Act of Parliament, courts sometimes need to interpret what the words actually mean. This is statutory interpretation, and examiners absolutely love it. There are four main rules, and you need all of them with case examples. The literal rule. Judges give words their ordinary, plain, dictionary meaning, even if the result seems absurd. The classic case is Whiteley v. Chapel, 1868. A man impersonated a dead person to vote. The court found him not guilty because a dead person is not entitled to vote. Absurd? Yes, but that's the literal rule. The golden rule allows judges to modify the literal meaning where applying it would lead to an absurd or repugnant outcome. The key case is R.V. Allen, 1872, a bigamy case. The literal meaning would have made it impossible to commit the offence, so the court used the golden rule to give the word marry a different meaning. The mischief rule dates back to the Hayden case of 1584. Judges look at what gap in the old law Parliament intended to fix, then interpret the act to suppress that mischief. The brilliant case is Smith v. Hughes, 1960. Prostitutes solicited from windows of private houses. The Street Offences Act made it illegal to solicit in a public place. Technically, they were inside, but the court applied the mischief rule. The mischief was public nuisance, so they were guilty. The purposive approach is the modern approach, favoured by the European Court of Justice, and increasingly by English courts. Judges look at the overall purpose and intention of Parliament. A great case is Jones v. Tower Boot Company, 1997, where the Court of Appeal took a broad interpretation of the Race Relations Act to cover racial harassment at work. And don't forget ejusdem generis, Latin for of the same kind. When a list of specific words is followed by general words, the general words are limited to the same category as the specific ones.
Now, let's move on to one of the most fascinating areas of English law, the doctrine of judicial precedent. This is how judges make law through their decisions, and it's built on a principle called stare decisis, Latin for stand by what has been decided. The idea is beautifully simple. When a judge decides a case, that decision can become binding on future courts dealing with similar facts, but, and this is crucial, only the ratio decidendi is binding. That's the reason for the decision, the legal principle the judge applied to reach their conclusion. Everything else, the judge says, interesting observations, hypothetical examples, that's called obiter dicta, meaning things said by the way.
obiter dicta is only persuasive, not binding. For precedent to work, you need a court hierarchy. At the very top sits the Supreme Court, which binds every court below it. Below that is the Court of Appeal, which binds all courts below it and is generally bound by the Supreme Court. Then the High Court, which binds lower courts. And at the bottom, the Magistrates' Court and County Court, which don't create binding precedent at all. Now, here's a really important piece of legal history you must know for your exam, the 1966 Practice Statement. Before 1966, the House of Lords, which is now the Supreme Court, was absolutely bound by its own previous decisions. This led to some very unjust outcomes. So in 1966, the Lord Chancellor issued a practice statement saying that the House of Lords would, in future, treat its own previous decisions as normally binding, but would depart from them when it appeared right to do so. This was a massive change. A key example of it being used is the case of R.V. Howe in 1987, where the House of Lords departed from an earlier decision on duress as a defence to murder. Courts can also avoid following a precedent in other ways. They can distinguish the case, finding that the facts are materially different, so the precedent doesn't apply, or a higher court can overrule a precedent set by a lower court, and a court can reverse its own previous decision on appeal. Now, let's talk about equity. Equity developed historically as a separate system of law to remedy the harshness and rigidity of the common law. It was administered in the Court of Chancery by the Lord Chancellor. The key thing to know is that equity introduced new remedies that the common law didn't provide. The two most important equitable remedies for your exam are specific performance, where a court orders a party to carry out their contractual obligations, and rescission, where a contract is set aside as if it never existed. Right, let's move on to the people who work in our legal system. You need to know about judges, solicitors, barristers, magistrates, and jurors. Judges are appointed through the Judicial Appointments Commission, which was established by the Constitutional Reform Act 2005. This act was hugely important because it separated the judiciary from the executive and legislature, establishing genuine judicial independence. Senior judges, like High Court judges, are appointed by the monarch on the recommendation of the Lord Chancellor, following the Commission's selection process. Solicitors are the lawyers most people deal with directly. They provide legal advice, draft documents, and can represent clients in lower courts. Barristers are specialist advocates who represent clients in the higher courts. They're instructed by solicitors rather than directly by clients in most cases. Both solicitors and barristers must complete professional training and be admitted to their respective professional bodies. Magistrates, also called justices of the peace, are lay people, meaning they have no formal legal qualifications. They sit in panels of three in the Magistrates' Court and deal with the vast majority of criminal cases in England and Wales, around 95%. They're supported by a legally qualified court clerk. Jurors are members of the public selected to decide questions of fact in Crown Court trials. They must be aged between 18 and 75, registered to vote, and have lived in the UK for at least 5 years. Finally, let's look at civil dispute resolution. When people have civil disputes, contract disagreements, personal injury claims, they don't always have to go to court. Alternative dispute resolution, or ADR, offers several options. Negotiation is the simplest. The parties try to reach agreement themselves. Mediation involves a neutral third party helping the parties reach a voluntary agreement. Arbitration is more formal. An arbitrator hears both sides and makes a binding decision. And tribunals deal with specific types of dispute, like employment or immigration, offering a cheaper and quicker alternative to the courts. The advantages of ADR over court proceedings are significant. It's cheaper, quicker, less formal, and preserves relationships between the parties. The disadvantage is that some ADR methods, like mediation, are not binding. So if one party refuses to cooperate, you may end up in court anyway.
Right, now for the section I know you've been waiting for, exam tips and the most common mistakes I see students make. Let's make sure you're not one of them. Mistake number one, confusing the rules of statutory interpretation. I cannot tell you how many candidates write about the mischief rule when they mean the golden rule, or vice versa. Here's my memory trick. Think of the rules in order of age. The mischief rule is the oldest, from 1584. It's the historical one. The literal rule came next, as courts became more formal. The golden rule was the fix for when the literal rule produced absurd results. And the purposive approach is the modern one. Oldest to newest. Mischief, literal, golden, purposive. Or remember the mnemonic MLGP. Magistrates like good pudding. Mistake number two.
not providing both advantages and disadvantages when the question asks you to evaluate or assess. If the command word is evaluate, you must consider both sides and reach a conclusion. A one-sided answer will be capped at the lower mark bands. Always look at the command word first. It tells you exactly what the examiner wants. Mistake number three, getting the court hierarchy wrong. Remember, the Supreme Court is at the top, then the Court of Appeal, then the High Court. The Crown Court deals with serious criminal cases, but is not a major source of precedent. Don't confuse the Crown Court with the Court of Appeal. Mistake number four, forgetting specific legislation. Examiners award marks for naming specific acts. You must know the Parliament Acts 1911 and 1949, the Royal Assent Act 1967, the Constitutional Reform Act 2005, and the Legal Aid, Sentencing and Punishment of Offenders Act 2012. That last one is often called LASPO, and it significantly restricted access to legal aid. Mistake number five, misapplying the 1966 practice statement. It only applies to the Supreme Court, formerly the House of Lords. The Court of Appeal has its own rules about when it can depart from its previous decisions, set out in the case of Young versus Bristol Aeroplane Company, 1944. Don't say the Court of Appeal can use the 1966 practice statement. It can't. Now, for your exam technique. For short questions of 1 to 2 marks, just state the fact clearly and concisely. For 4 to 6 mark questions, use the Peel structure. Point, evidence, explain, link. Make your point, support it with a case or statute, explain why it matters, and link back to the question. For longer evaluate questions, make sure you cover both sides, advantages and disadvantages, and always end with a clear conclusion that directly answers the question 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 that directly. Time management. Allow roughly 1 minute per mark. So a 6 mark question should take about 6 to 7 minutes. Don't spend 20 minutes on a 2 mark question. Right, quickfire recall quiz time. I'll ask the question, give you a moment to think, then give you the answer. Ready? Question 1. What Latin term means stand by what has been decided? The answer is stare decisis. Question 2. Which part of a judgment is binding on future courts? The ratio decidendi or the obiter dicta? The ratio decidendi is binding. Obiter dicta is only persuasive. Question 3. In which year did the House of Lords issue the practice statement allowing it to depart from its previous decisions? 1966. Question 4. Name the 3 types of delegated legislation. Orders in council, statutory instruments, and bylaws. Question 5. What does ultra vires mean, and in what context is it used in relation to delegated legislation? Ultra vires means beyond the powers. Courts can declare delegated legislation ultra vires if it exceeds what the parent act authorised. Question 6. Which act established the Judicial Appointments Commission? The Constitutional Reform Act 2005. 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 Brilliant! How did you do? If you got all 6, you're in great shape. If you missed some, go back and review those sections. They're prime exam material. Let me leave you with the 5 most important things to remember from today's episode. 1. Parliamentary sovereignty. Parliament is supreme and can make or unmake any law. 2. Know all 4 rules of statutory interpretation, with a case example for each. 3. The 1966 practice statement allows the Supreme Court to depart from its own previous decisions. 4. Delegated legislation comes in 3 forms. Orders in council, statutory instruments, and bylaws, and can be controlled by Parliament or struck down by courts as ultra vires. 5. The Constitutional Reform Act 2005 established the Judicial Appointments Commission and judicial independence. You've got this. Go review your notes, test yourself with the practice questions in your study guide, and remember, every mark you earn in that exam is a mark you've worked for. Good luck, and I'll see you in the next episode.